This is Listen to the Editors, a series of interviews with journal editors to unveil the trends in research for operations and supply chain management. This is your host, Yuri Gavronsky. Today, we are interviewing the co-editors-in-chief for the Journal of Operations Management. Dr. Suzanne de Treville and Dr. Tyson Browning will be joining us today. Dr. Suzanne de Treville is a full professor of operations management at the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Lausanne. Her research areas include competitive manufacturing in a high-cost environment, supply chain management and lead time reduction, lean production, process consistency improvement, healthcare operations, and queuing theory-based mathematical modeling of operations. Dr. Tyson R. Browning is a full professor of operations management in the Neely School of Business at Texas Christian University, where he conducts research on managing complex projects, integrating managerial and engineering perspectives, and teaches MBA courses on project management, operations management, risk management, and process improvement. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Or good afternoon for you, Suzanne, right? So we will start with some highlights about the Journal of Operations Management. How do you read the mission of the journal?
Well, so if we go back about 25 years, operations was front and center very suddenly. We had gone from scientific management to, by the way, this stuff is really strategic. And if we get this right, we will be able to compete more strongly. We will be able to innovate better. All kinds of good things will happen. We'll be better able to take care of people. There was a lot of excitement. And then suddenly, the accession of China to the World Trade Organization precipitated an enormous shift to away from strategic operations and toward it's all about cost. Well, when we only focus on cost, then we end up losing the ability to innovate, to really take care of people. It becomes much harder to take care of the environment, and we end up with imbalanced manufacturing. And this has been very frustrating for those of us who have been in the field for a while. And suddenly what we see is that the energy is coming back to manufacturing. And one of the things that is very important to us is that we are better understanding manufacturing as a service operation that happens to deliver a product, which offers all kinds of new opportunities. So we're going for it. And we saw 25, 30 years ago, well, I saw 25, 30 years ago, that there was a window of opportunity that really let things change, let research have an impact on what companies do, how they act, and there were tremendous benefits from that. When that energy went away, people were worse off. Government, you know, economic regions were worse off. So our hope is that we would open the door for research that would really lead to new understanding and capitalize on this energy that we're seeing. And we want to focus not only about quote-unquote efficient manufacturing, but we really do want to see more innovation, more ability to take care of the environment, and more ability to take care of people. Okay, Tyson, over to you.
Yeah, I would say over the history of the journal, it's definitely moved from a production manufacturing focused and centric to a much larger view of how to manage work across product, service, provision, and even across organizations. Of course, supply chain is a huge concern now. We're starting to view work less in terms of some of just the OR optimization problems that confront small areas of work in large organizations, but we're looking also at a system level view across organizations and among organizations and entire supply networks. So how does this system of work across the world now really affect what practicing operations managers need to do on a day-to-day and also year-to-year, multi-year strategic levels of decisions? So I would say the journal's mission is very broad in terms of operations management, conceived broadly, operations management writ large, managing work within and across organizations at all levels, strategic down to tactical. And it's also important as far as JOM's mission to emphasize that we do that through empirical research. So unlike some of our peer journals, we are very empirically focused, meaning that we are looking at this scientifically, collecting data, and hopefully through that, maintaining the strong link to practice and practical relevance, which is very important.
So let me tell you a short story. My university is a non-departmental university, so we were invited from the business school to talk to the other programs. So we were invited in a meeting with the computer science program, and they have approved a grant for researching healthcare and IoT and things like that, and we were sitting with them to understand where they were going. And when they were talking about their projects, for example, one of those had a grant from the government, but also had some money from Siemens to implement a new computer thing in a hospital using Siemens technology. I was listening to them and thinking I would be struggling to publish something if I were working with them, because my research would be seen as consulting, and probably would be, right? So I would find very hard publishing something with them on this topic. Would you have a way to collaborate with guys in other areas, other fields?
So we actually have set up a new department. It was not we. This was done by Miko and Dan.
Previous EIC.
Which is design science. So design science has been popularized in the information systems field and has been quite effective. Now, what we have discovered is that, so Tyson, I'm going to go out on a limb and then, you clean up the pieces. But what we have discovered is that design science in the classical sense sometimes is not optimal for capturing the knowledge that the project that you're describing, Yuri, would produce. And so we are realizing that the thing that we need to incubate, because why do you have a department? You have a department because you want to incubate something. You want to bring together people who really know what they're doing so they can help it be everything that it can be. So what we need to incubate is, first of all, interventionist research. So somebody goes into a company, they take existing knowledge, they take theory, they take artifacts, they apply it, and if it goes perfectly, it's just a normal consulting project, then there's no paper. You're not going to publish a paper in JOM based on that. However, what typically happens is you take the best of theory and you implement it, and stuff happens that nobody would have ever dreamed of. This isn't just, IoT or Internet of Things, or it isn't just a software program or an app. It can also be a mathematical model. It can also be even a theory or a framework. And you sit there and you say, wait, what? How did that happen? And that type of emergent knowledge, which gives you insight into what is, what are some things that we never thought about before, but if we can understand them, we can do this better. That's the type of knowledge that we're trying to capture through the design science department.
Often we'll come back as a new generalizable theory and research questions, ideally. So we learn something that could potentially apply more broadly than just that one project.
And building on that, so what do we mean by empirical? So some people think that empirical means we've got a great big data set. But empirical means that we go out and we observe. We have data on what is actually going on. And we're defining science as learning from observation. And we're realizing that sometimes the best way to move knowledge forward is through empirically grounding research questions. So we would rather have a short paper that captures something that helps us understand what is the next question to address and supports it well with observation than a paper that is neat and tidy but is simply not very interesting.
Yeah, and I'll add that I test the limits all the time. And I often work with engineering people. I'm on the fence with that discipline myself. And in 2010, I published a paper in JOM that was based on a consulting project I did with a large organization. So it's possible, but to make that into a JOM type paper, I had to connect it to the theory that it's emerging from. I had to explain how the data then could provide some new insights that would perhaps lead to new theory, modified theory, or future research towards those things. So I think consulting projects can be research as well as consulting, but of course you have to be careful of how you do that. And you've got to make sure you're coming in with a firm set of approaches grounded in theory that you can then compare against reality. And if there's a significant delta there, then you've got a possibility to contribute back to the world of theory. So consulting is great if it's a vehicle for data collection and observation that allows you to do that. But if it's just a vehicle for, in most cases, you know, the theory is sufficient to solve the problem in the organization, at least 90%+ of it, because organizations are so busy, they're just not paying attention to what somebody somewhere already knows. But oftentimes there are new problems discovered out there, new opportunities discovered out there. And academicians, we don't always want to just be looking in the rearview mirror and trying to explain what industry has previously done. We want to also be about next practices, not just best practices. So if we're going to do that, if we're going to really stay on the cutting edge with research, we're going to have to be out there uncovering what the latest challenges are.
I'd like to do a slightly deeper dive on this delta that Tyson mentioned. Dan Guy, the previous co-EIC, had this idea that is this paper, does it make a contribution that's worth considering? So you look at the delta. What do you know after reading the paper that you didn't know before? And we find that that's actually a very elegant way. We use that all the time, to justify either going ahead with a paper or saying, no, it's pretty, it's well written, it's nice, but it's simply not, not enough.
Doesn't tell us much new. Yeah.
By the way, there's one other thing I would like to add, and that is that this idea of what I'll call interventionist research, a kind of operations management based view of what can come out of design science, gives a nice way of doing something which we really think needs to happen if the field is going to be as strong as it can be, which is to better link operations research and operations management. What's happened is that operations research has been off in its corner, operations management, empirical, has been off in its corner, and
even it fragments into the analytical and empirical camps at times. So
exactly. And so what is basically happening is that you've got an operations research model. Let's say it's very elegant. In order to get published in a good journal, there's probably going to be a few assumptions that take it pretty far away from the real world. And then people say, okay, we're done. It's elegant. It's beautiful. Let's just all admire it. And by the way, it was published in this prestigious journal. And then if somebody comes and says, you know what, I implemented that model and I ran into these problems and I discovered that this is how things tend to go, you could not get a paper like that published. But that's what we need to do if operations research is to actually be useful to decision making. Mm-hmm. So following this interventionist research way of thinking, we're saying, all right, so you've got this theoretical model and you take it into practice and some surprising things happen. Again, you know, we're looking for the delta. This falls generally under the category of abductive reasoning. You've got inductive, deductive logic, but then abductive means that you thought you had it all figured out and then something came and slapped you in the face and you're like, gee whiz, that I've got to reframe my problem. So we're finding that taking a mathematical model into a company and actually having real managers make decisions may be a source of abductive reasoning and new ideas. That's enough to warrant publication. And I know from experience that getting those papers published, even if you learn stuff that completely changes the usefulness of the model, that's hard. So we're trying to make that a bit easier, which is really interesting because what's been happening over the past few decades is that somebody comes up with this beautiful model and then you throw it over the wall to the users and say, what, you guys can't figure this out? What's wrong with you?
Can't apply.
But if we don't provide incentives in terms of you do this work, then it can contribute to knowledge, then we're going to fail. And by the way, if we look at biology, this type of research is very common.
And it's somewhat analogous to what we call our last mile problem in the delivery systems. In research, what's the problem with making that final connection to practice and practical relevance? And a lot of the models that make so many simplifying assumptions just to get a closed form solution are too far removed from reality. And so what can we do to bridge that gap and test in the field whether or not those models really contribute something? So JOM is interested in that type of research. The model could be published in another journal. You might summarize it in a page or two in an appendix in JOM, and the paper itself is mostly about the empirical testing of that model and what we learn.
Okay. I would be glad to post in the show notes the link to your paper, 2010 paper, so our listeners can have an example.
Yes.
And if you recall, Suzanne, any example that you recall published recently in the journal that you'd like to mention, I'll be glad to post as well, because this type of research is quite rare and people sometimes would benefit from having an example where they can build upon to do their own papers, right?
Well, Yuri, that would be really great, because one of the things that we're finding is it's not only a question of signaling to authors that we're open to this kind of paper, but it's also something that we are figuring out together with our department and our associate editors. It's not like, oh, we're flipping a switch and now everything's easy. We really need to look at this. So what happens is that a paper like this will come in. You know, maybe Tyson or I have, we're both extremely persuasive people, so we'll track somebody down and say, we like your paper. It's going in a direction that is consistent with where we want to take the journal. This is interesting. And they go, okay, this is great. They submit it. And then, the reaction of the review team is, this is not a JOM paper. Well, my first paper was in JOM in 1986, and it was analytical, but it came directly out of observation. So you can say, well, the journal has kind of changed since then. But quite frankly, I look back at that paper and say, you know, I learned a lot writing that paper. It helped me to pull together a lot of what I was observing. So I don't think that we should so narrowly define the journal that we lose our ability to have the impact that we want to have. And, you know, coming back to this idea of science is learning from observation. You learn from observation, we're interested. So we can share with you a few examples of papers that a lot of people would say, that's not a JOM paper. And we're like, says who?
Well, at least here's an example in JOM. So we can go from there. And this is something Suzanne and I generally have been trying to do since we began, is to kind of enlarge people's view of what a JOM paper can be. And this includes our own reviewers and editors, not just potential authors. For example, we've added some departments on subject areas that tend to get underemphasized in various past JOM publications. Recently, we've added several departments. The most recent one is called Innovation and Project Management, IPM. We've, as Suzanne mentioned, the Design Science Department is not in the last year, but it's still relatively new, although we've got probably a good half dozen or more papers now that have been published in JOM through that department, and that's several more in the pipeline. So that's good. We've got an empirical research methods and operations management department that serves a couple purposes, and we'll probably come back to that in a few minutes. We've got a public policy department that is looking at how operations management decisions and issues can affect public policy and vice versa. So we've got an operations interfaces department that is looking at how operations management connects with other functions in the organization, such as human resources, marketing, finance, accounting, information systems, and so on. Lots of possibilities there. That department has been getting a lot of submissions, especially in the last year. So we're trying to expand subject-wise how people think of JOM and what's publishable there. And then, as Suzanne was mentioning, methods-wise. And then in a recent editorial we put out, we talked about how JOM is open to high-quality literature reviews, conceptual papers, and these type of empirically grounded analytic approaches that we've just been talking about. So I think there's a lot of possibilities, and we're starting to see some submissions that start to go into these areas that we're looking to expand. We think this is important to keep OM as a broad, vibrant, open, growing, dynamic community, which we see as essential to the growth and future of the field. We certainly don't want it to, over time, become more and more limited, more and more guarded, more and more protective. These are negative descriptions of a community like we want to have. So I think there's a lot of possibilities for even more transdisciplinary connectivity with other areas of management, marketing, and other subfields around that all have big opportunities to influence the way operations managers think. And really, in today's interconnected world, operations managers have to consider the effects of their decisions on these other functions and be able to make their voice heard as other functions make their decisions. What will the impact be on operations? So there are many possibilities, and often these questions become apparent if researchers will spend a little time in companies and listening to what managers are really dealing with on a day-to-day basis in companies. So I think consulting projects, sometimes the specific project itself might not be publishable, but the opportunity for researchers to be around practicing managers and executives and hear what challenges, what problems they're facing, even if it's not specifically on that one consulting project, is extremely valuable.
Okay, let me get back to a more practical question. How many issues per year do you publish?
We publish 8 issues per year.
How many papers per issue or per year?
What would you say to us?
So typically we've been around 4 right now, but a little above that. But we're looking to push that towards 5 to 6. That's 5 to 6 papers per issue would be our preference, I think. In 2018, we published 34 papers total, so just slightly over 4 per issue, and we're on track to exceed that this year, and we would love to be in the 40 to 50 per year range, I think, which would work out to 5 to 6 per year. More than that would be fine, too. We have no limits, no budgets, no quotas in terms of we can only publish so many pages or so many papers. Our problem is just the lack of high quality papers.
Because that's the reason of my question. I mean, if you were trying to broaden the scope of what is a JOM paper, right? So if you include more, you probably have a higher rate of submissions. And then how do you manage those increasing numbers without increasing the number of papers? But if you...
Right. So we're not really looking to increase just the number of incoming submissions, but we would love to increase the number of high quality incoming submissions. Mm-hmm. Right now, we desk reject about 60% of submissions right off the top. Some of those with input from department editors, but probably 49, 50% of those just Suzanne and I desk reject for various reasons. And then that means about 40% of papers we get currently go into our review process. So it would be great if we could send 60, 70, 80% of incoming papers into the review process because they look like they've got potential. And the good news is this year, that number has been going up. So far in 2019, we've had to desk reject fewer than 50%. So that's an improvement.
How many submissions a year?
About 700.
But one of the things is if you take a kind of a systems viewpoint or an operations viewpoint of the publishing process, there's a lot that can be done to give feedback. So we're trying to give more feedback to authors that whose papers are desk rejected, but we can see that there's some potential there. So we'll now try to get feedback, for example, from the department editor of the empirical methods department on, so you started out wrong when you were setting up your survey and you made it so that it would never reach a level it would be publishable in JOM. But here's something that you could think about the next time you're setting up a survey so that it would have a higher probability of being successful. And that feedback's been very appreciated. We're also working, you know, the shift to the department editor structure means that you now have a team that is learning how to accept papers as opposed to gatekeep. And that was a decision that was made by the previous EICs. And, you know, there was a dip as department editors, I was department editor at the time, learned how to accept papers. Because it's scary to accept a paper. You're saying, okay, I'm making the decision that this paper is worthy of being science. But people are now getting into it. And we see a lot of our department editors becoming really good at helping authors get over the threshold. And if the authors are willing to put the work in, now it's not easy. And, you know, it might mean that we've got a few extra rounds, but papers that would have been rejected now are, you know, coming together. Especially.
We've also been using this reject and resubmit option more than previous editors had. We really view it as a place where papers that have some interesting ideas and have some potential, but there's just so much work to do that a typical major revision even is probably not going to do it. So it's not that we don't want to ever see a paper on this topic again. It's that we're going to send the authors back to the drawing board with a lot of constructive guidance and say, if you can assimilate all this and come back to us with a new submission that addresses these major concerns, that gets around any significant methodological, theoretical, conceptual, other types of issues like that, then we'd be happy to take another look at it. So we have to desk reject some of those, but in many cases, we've seen authors be able to come back and address a lot of the major concerns that otherwise would have just maybe previously been reject and go elsewhere.
I think one thing to bring in here is the idea, like, so some people have this idea that editors are, you know, they're not quite God, but they're like the oracle and they know everything and they look at the paper and then, you know, but no, the editors are the ones who manage the peer review process. Now, peer reviewers are also not oracles. They are peers. And if they can't understand it, putting more time in than most other people who are going to read the paper, then something's got to change before it's worth going forward to publication. So when you think about it, that we're managing the peer review process, then you take a paper, and let's suppose that you've got two reviewers, an AE, who all say, no, I do not see a future for this paper, not even reject and resubmit, because here are 14 things that are wrong. And the DE says, you know, I've looked at all these arguments. I'm in agreement with the arguments. I've looked at the paper. I do not see a future. Even there, if we have authors who say, you know what, I have just gotten 20 pages of feedback from, you know, a pretty toothy review team, but you know, a lot of this, they didn't see a way to address it, but I know how to do it. And so they come back and they say, you know what, you didn't even give a reject and resubmit decision, but would you take a look at my arguments? And if somebody has some really strong arguments, why wouldn't we take a little bit of time to take a look? You know, this is not about power. This is about, we want to publish good papers. We want to help people do good research. We want to encourage each other, and we want to learn how to help people learn. So it's really funny, because the review team, sometimes we will give a reject and resubmit decision. I'm more likely to do it than I was a couple of years ago, just because I think if four very smart people who know the area have given this quantity of feedback, there's got to be the possibility that the authors would be able to pull something out of it. And if they do, I'll take a look. And then, so that's what I explained to the review team. When they say, we told you there was no hope for this paper, how is it that you would give them a chance? And it's like, well, you know, in the worst case, we desk reject the version that comes that doesn't address the points.
So what would be the grounds for desk rejection? What are the main reasons for desk rejecting a paper?
Yeah, Tyson.
Probably the most common reasons are papers are submitted to JOM that just aren't really empirical research. We get analytical models, optimization models that we say, you know, this might be an awesome paper, but we're not the right home for it. Please submit it to one of our peer OM journals that looks at analytical models, for example, or an OR journal that's looking at optimization, and you're going to have a better chance there. So that's one. Another problem is some papers are sufficiently about operations management. They're essentially finance papers or marketing papers that I'm assuming probably got rejected at some other field journal in one of those disciplines. And now they're saying, well, let's try something and we'll throw a few OM terms in there maybe. But you can tell from the reference list, if nothing else, when there's very little, if any, OM referencing, that they've just not made much effort to ground this in the OM literature or theories that are relevant to operations management. So that's another one. Some papers are just low quality, poor writing, poor methodology, and we see that right away. Other papers we suspect have methodological weaknesses, but Suzanne and I can't be an expert in every methodology. So one of the purposes of our empirical research methods department is we send a number of new submissions for an initial methods check in this department. And our department editor there, Miko Ronko, and his department are excellent at giving an initial quick methods screening, methods review that can come back with some very useful guidance to authors if there's significant problems, and really empower Suzanne or me to desk reject something for fatal flaws in the methods. At the same time, sometimes the methods review will say there are some likely weaknesses here, but the authors should better explain what they're doing, why they're doing it, and this will put them in a better position going into the review process. So there's benefits there as well as screening. Back to reasons for desk rejection, we often get submissions that have high similarity scores. We run all new submissions through plagiarism detection software. And so when it shows us double-digit percentages in similarity with other published papers, that's a big red flag for us. Some of these are fixable, and we'll ask authors to please reduce the similarity by actually writing things in their own words. And other times, I've seen some really egregious examples where 50 to 80% of the paper is just cut and paste from other papers. Sometimes the author's own previous works, which they no longer own the copyrights to because they've transferred those to other publishers. So even if they have permission to use the papers in their teaching and so forth, they really don't have permission to copy and paste from them into new works that they're submitting as original to journals. So plagiarism problems, especially self-plagiarism, can be a concern. And then probably the fifth reason for desk rejections are just insufficient contribution. There's just not much delta, to use that term from Dan Guide that we mentioned earlier. In other words, the paper looks nice in some ways, but at the end, in the conclusion, what do we really learn? What's the so what question here? Sometimes Suzanne and I can see that right away. Sometimes we're not an expert in the sub area, so we send it to a department editor who comes back to us with input in their particular area of expertise. This just really isn't a new contribution. There's just not much new here on top of what we already know. So these are probably the most common reasons for desk rejection.
Okay. How long is the tenure for the editor-in-chief for the Journal of Operations Management? Is that any fixed?
Yeah, we do a three-year term with an option for a second three-year term. So 3 to 6 years. And we're about 17 months in to our first term.
You change the editorial board when you assume?
We don't do that drastically. We do it gradually. So similarly, our department editors have three-year terms. So since Suzanne and I have taken over, we've probably turned over, what would you say, Suzanne, a little more than half?
Yeah.
Of our about, 17 department editors or so, somewhere around there. We've tried to do it so that they're not all leaving at the same time, finishing a term at the same time. We want there to be a lot of continuity. So we have a lot of overlapping terms, people beginning the beginning of the year, the middle of the year, and so on.
Is there any logic of this the composition of this board? I mean, do you aim at any sort of, diversity?
We do.
Very much so.
We would love to increase this diversity, especially internationally.
Yeah.
And we have done this a bit, but we'd like to do it even more. However, even though most of our department editors, for example, are based in the U.S., probably half of them were not born in the U.S. So they are international scholars who've chosen to work at U.S. institutions. So when you look at it that way, we do have a pretty good international diverse department editor board and associate editor board and editorial review board. So we've got those three levels right now, and we may have some further developments here in the future with an advisory board. So lots of boards to think about in that sense. We don't usually refer to our department editors or associate editors as a board specifically, but in the broadest sense, you could really, of course, consider them as part of the editorial review board.
Anything you'd like to see accomplished during your tenure as a co-editors-in-chief?
So many things. Suzanne and I come up with things faster than we can accomplish them. But
yeah.
We have done several things behind the scenes operationally. The department structure we currently have, for example, is still only a few years old. And so Suzanne and I have been doing quite a bit to kind of, you could say, formalize, standardize some of the governance and operations of the journal itself behind the scenes. And another big area where we'd like to see progress is what we've already discussed as far as having people view JOM broadly in terms of topic and method that we consider.
So let me add, one of the big things that's taken a huge amount of our time during the first year and a half has been the transition to a new publisher. And both publishers have, wonderful qualities, and, we've been very well served by both. But there's a certain energy and a certain rebooting that comes from doing something as drastic as changing changing publishers. It was not for the faint of heart. Getting all the manuscripts in the Elsevier editorial system into Scholar One. Now, with Scholar One, there are opportunities to collect better data on reviewers. Scholar One is a very flexible system. So we're really thinking about, you know, again, taking a process perspective of managing the flow from submission through publication. You know, how can we really improve the yield at various points of the process, including work on reviewer development. Now, there's one thing about Wiley that I think is going to end up making a big difference. We're already seeing this, and I think we're going to see it much more, which is that Wiley has a fairly substantial stable of operations management journals. They publish Palm, they publish the Journal of Supply Chain Management,
Decision Sciences, yeah.
Yeah, so that what this means is that, you know, when you're publishing, for example, we get an idea for how to develop reviewers. That is the water that's lifting all of the proverbial boats. And, you know, all of these editors know each other. We work together for, you know, a really long time. And the idea is that a good paper, we will work together to help it find a home. A person who is interested in this type of service, we will work together to put them to work and help them do good things. And then, you know, we would like to be developing authors. We have a lot of ideas on the method side, because there's so much that can be done. One of the things which is emerging is that for certain areas in empirical research, JOM is turning out to play an important leadership role. With one, you know, somewhat controversial question, I was doing some research on various listservs, et cetera, and I discovered that in research on chemotherapy, articles on this area of methods, articles in JOM were being cited by people who are doing research on chemotherapy. So I thought, good, that's great stuff.
Right. My own goals for the journal would be that JOM starts to get some additional greater recognition outside of just the core OM community. So as Suzanne was mentioning, managing work, managing operations is a fairly universal need in the world of managing anything, not just factories, but hospitals, services, and so on. So how can we raise awareness of the research results published in JOM to practitioners in these areas and to academicians in our sister fields? So there's a lot of opportunity and possibility there.
I had a fun thing happen over this past week. There's an article that is currently on my desk. And the question is, well, but yeah, so it's a nice article, it's well written. Does it really make a contribution? So I thought, well, I happen to know someone. So being close to Geneva, then we're surrounded by intergovernmental organizations, and I happen by, you know, just by proximity to know the person who has been heading the department that looks at this kind of question at the World Trade Organization. So I thought, well, you know, the review team's a little stuck. And, you know, I personally think this is interesting, but I manage the process. I'm not the reviewer. But what I can do is go to someone who's dealing with this kind of question and say, do you think this is interesting? And this is someone who publishes a lot himself and is also a very skeptical, critical person. So I thought, we're safe. Well, he looked at the article immediately and said, oh, I didn't know you all were doing this kind of research. These are the questions that we need to have answered. And if this article gets published, I'm going to cite it. I said, that's interesting. So I asked him to actually do a full review of the article, which I'm then going to send to the review team. And we can also communicate this to the author saying, you need to do a better job at marketing your stuff. And, you know, it might take a while and it might be a little grouchy, but, you know, so.
Explaining to whom it's relevant and motivating it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because sometimes we'll have reviewers who are, of course, purely academicians say, this doesn't seem interesting, or is this really solving a problem? Well, if you can have someone who's living that come and say, yeah, this is a problem and we would love to solve it, then it gives the academic reviewers more confidence to say, okay, I believe this is important. Now I just can focus on, can I trust the results?
And then everybody's working together to help the authors to market their problem. And if we do that, that's how the journal is going to be at its best. And that's how the field is going to be at its best. Because we have dealt with a real bias, which is that what are the research questions? The research questions are selected by the ones that you can get data for in the time that it takes you to get your tenure package together or, you know, get your PhD written. And so this means that we have questions that are simply so non-interesting. And so we would rather have relatively small, short, single idea papers, but that are asking questions where we don't know the answer. Now there's
right. That move us down the field, so to speak, not just, as Suzanne, you like to say, not every kick is a shot on goal.
Exactly.
Sometimes you need to pass the ball downfield first and set someone else up.
Teaching people how to pass. More like, so our job is a lot like coaching in that respect. One thing which is worth mentioning is that the journal is owned by APEX, now the Association for Supply Chain Management, which is an industry association with a very large number of practitioners as members. And the journal has not been front and center over the past years for APEX or ASCM, but now they have kind of new interest in understanding what we do. So one of some of the things that we're considering are working together with APEX members to collect data. We're open to the idea of someone submitting a research design that would be conditionally accepted, and then we would help work with APEX to collect data. So we're waiting for a really strong proposal, and APEX is happy to explore that. The other thing is hearing from APEX members what their research topics are, what they don't know. So
what would they consider an interesting question as practitioners? And getting specific sometimes. I mean, they generally have topics like, I want to be more resilient to supply chain risk.
I think Tyson,
well, of course,
this discussion,
pretty generic.
Let's get we can almost
specific.
Think about what we're doing as being
there?
A little bit like a configurator. Mm-hmm. So we're taking big, poorly specified questions on the industry side, and we're breaking them down into researchable questions.
Right. And this bridge building between industry groups and academicians is a slow process. So we take opportunities where we can, and it's slow. It's not going to happen immediately, but Suzanne and I will be going to the ASCM conference this year for the first time, and JOM will have a lot of visibility there. So we're trying to get practitioners to pay attention to results that are already existing and forthcoming in JOM. And then hopefully through that awareness can start to get them thinking about how maybe in the future JOM could answer questions they initiate rather than just let them react to what we produce.
So I have a question for you about the editorial process. I normally ask the editors to walk the listeners to their editorial process because several journals have different process, but I understand that you have multiple processes. If I understood, for example, I can have a full paper that I submit, or I can have a research proposal. I can have a strong research idea that I don't have data for, and you can connect us.
Well, that's something we're aspiring to. We do not yet have that formalized. So that's an initiative that Suzanne and I would like to achieve before we finish.
Oh, I see. How would that happen? I mean, the listeners that are interested in such research would send you a proposal over email, or that would be in the journal system?
Well, we're going to work on formalizing that, but our goal would be to have that be something that could be submitted through the online submission system as well. But right now, the formal process is very, you could say, traditional in the sense you submit regular papers, although we also take what we call technical notes. And then JOM also publishes occasional pieces that are opinion pieces called forum pieces. And these are by invitation only, but some of these invitations can be requested by submitting, you know, a draft or something. And Suzanne and I will take a look at it and say, yeah, please submit it as a forum paper. And the forum papers are intended to be, they're not editorials because they're not from the editors typically, but they are essentially similar opinion pieces, usually from senior people in the field who we are hoping will be somewhat provocative in what they're saying and ideally would stimulate some good conversation and discussion around the points they're raising, maybe even causing a counterpoint forum piece in a future issue. So those are a couple of the possibilities.
Yeah, we're definitely not afraid of discussion. And one of the things that happens to junior people is they observe that people are making irrational decisions, and they say people are doing this irrational thing, and we would like to actually show that if they do this, it'll be better. And you know, they've got data, and it's nice. And the reviewers say, but this irrational thing, nobody would ever do that. What's really great is when somebody senior sticks their neck out and says, well, we know that this irrational thing absolutely makes sense. And, you know, that probably releases, you know, five papers. So it's, you know, so the point counterpoint is very strong. Or with methods pieces, we like to publish pieces that are, that give guidance for how to get the methods right. And then sometimes you'll have another group of authors who think that this is too strict and that there would be space for having something a bit looser. And so they will submit a response, and we are open to that kind of dialogue because that's how learning takes place.
What are technical notes?
Technical notes are typically short, maybe a third to half the length of a regular paper, that tend to focus on a particular technical point, maybe methodological, but it's often necessary to clarify some misconceptions or misuses of methodologies, something like that, but maybe not enough to justify a full regular methods paper. But if it's an important point, albeit a lesser one perhaps than a major full paper, then there's potential to publish it as a technical note.
Okay, and in the full paper, what would be the regular process for that? You get the paper and then...
Yeah, so Suzanne and I look at all regular papers, one or the other of us. We'll look at each new submission that comes in. And we have a managing editor who will technically look at it first and make sure that they've included all the things that are required. But then Suzanne or I will look at it and either desk reject it or send it to a department editor. So we decide which department editor to send it to. We look at authors' recommendations for department that they think it would be a good fit for. When submitting a paper, they can give a first and second choice there. But ultimately, it's Suzanne or I deciding which department a paper really goes to, which department editor specifically, because some departments have more than one, DE. Then the department editor takes a look at it with the option, of course, to come back and suggest a desk rejection or an immediate revision. But typically, they will send the paper out for review, meaning they're the ones assembling the review team, which consists of typically two reviewers, typically one, at least one of whom would be from our editorial review board, and one associate editor. So the two reviewers and the associate editor start looking at the paper in parallel, but then once the two reviewers' reports are submitted, the associate editor receives those and has a couple more weeks to assimilate those reviewer reports with their own perceptions and evaluations from the review. Once this AE report and recommendation is complete, it goes back to the department editor, who similarly looks at the reviews and the AE report and sends a report and recommendation to Suzanne or to me, whichever one of us had looked at the paper first. and assigned it to a department editor, and then we'll get back to the authors with the decision. So this is really more layers than some other journals' review processes. So we've typically been doing very well on the effectiveness side. From what I see compared to other journals I've worked with, and I've worked with several others, JOM provides extremely high quality reviews, very thorough, hopefully constructive and developmental in tone, a lot of good guidance there. Our challenge with so many layers is more the efficiency side. How do we get back to authors in a timely manner? And our goal would be to get back within 3 months or about 90 days on each round of submissions. We are often able to do that, but there are still too many exceptions to that that we're working on reducing. So our average is well below 90, but that's because we have so many desk rejections. I would say for papers that go out for review, the average lately is probably in the 80s, but there's still a large standard deviation that we need to work on. So, but we would always rather err on getting a good review team. And there can be problems with reviewers. Sometimes, you know, they don't follow through on an invitation to, or they don't follow through on a deadline. We're, again, better than most other journals I've worked with because our ERB members and our AEs commit to a minimum number of reviews per year. So they will typically accept invitations. But like anyone, things can come up that delay them. And sometimes we have to work around those. So that's probably the most common reasons for missing our 90-day goal is just occasionally a reviewer or an AE will have some sort of crisis or difficulty that just sets them back a few weeks.
So a couple of things. One is that the methods review that we have increasingly been adding to papers with complex methods, it might make things a bit longer, but it also means that a paper that comes in with complex methods then has the methods really get waterproof before it goes to a regular review team. And this means that the review team doesn't have to focus on trying to figure out a method that resembles things that they've seen, but it's not exactly the same, and they're kind of nervous, and then they're wondering, they know that there's all this concern about things like endogeneity, is this too much, or is this okay? Our methods reviewers are expert in those particular questions, so we can get all of that resolved. Now we say the methods are good. Does it make the contribution?
So the reviewers, the regular reviewers, they get as well the report from the...
They're informed that it has passed a methods check.
So the regular reviewers might just be told that it's passed an initial methods check from a methods expert. I believe the associate editor, definitely the department editor, would get a full report from the methods department.
I'm not sure if
each individual reviewer gets that full report. They probably just get word that it has been checked and successfully passed that hurdle.
A summary.
So, but we'll often have reviewers who are good with particular methods themselves. And if they want to weigh in, of course, they're welcome. And then we also have some reviewers who will admit that I'm not an expert in this method. And it's like in OR journals, you have to check the box. Did I check the equations or not? And so we similarly will have occasional reviewers who say, you know, I didn't check the regression models myself or something like that. So there are different levels of depth in reviews and different capabilities in terms of expertise among reviewers.
Okay. So let me move to another subject. You already mentioned that one of the KPIs that you have is the length of the round, right? So any other KPIs that you use for measuring the journal or the journal reputation, what do you look specifically when in your regular managerial process of the journal?
Well, thankfully, we've got a good reputation already. So what we want to do is keep that. Kind of like deans will say they are not trying to just manage to the rankings. We similarly are not just trying to do that. but clearly we understand that things like citation counts and impact factors can make a difference to the journal. We're not tracking those day to day. We're not trying to make specific accept, reject decisions about papers based on those. But in the aggregate, in the grand scheme, we are looking at that. We're pleased that JOMs rank first or second in impact factor assessments among management science and operations research journals in many cases. So that's a good thing for the journal overall. We are trying to, like we said, publish more high-quality papers. Right now, our acceptance rate is below 5%. It's been as low as probably 1% or 2% in the last couple of years. So we're not targeting that. We just keep an eye on that and think about why is it what it is and what can we do to hopefully even increase that. Personally, I'd like to see the acceptance rate between 5 to 10% as a next step, because I don't think it's a badge of honor to say you reject 97, 98% of papers. That might be a good thing for some people's prestige scores, but I would rather get more high quality papers and have to reject fewer of them and publish more of them. I would rather see the field get stronger methodologically and in the types of research questions it's addressing, so that more good research is coming and that research is coming from more places. So we'd mentioned diversity in terms of department editors and editorial board earlier. We also would love to have more diversity in terms of where the research papers are coming from. We do get submissions from all over the world, but the level of rigor varies quite a bit. The level of training available for PhD students and junior faculty varies quite a bit in universities around the world. So hopefully over time, we see JOM as having a part to play in helping raise the water level of capability worldwide by giving constructive developmental feedback as much as we can. But authors have to kind of achieve a certain level before really we have the resources to be able to give feedback on how to go up yet another level. But hopefully over time, that will enable more and more people and more places to do more and more interesting research.
You can think about it as a process yield, so that if you've got better quality raw material, then the yield is going to go up, you know, by itself. And as we communicate, okay, if you're doing this type of survey or this type of qualitative research, or if you are going to try interventionist design science research, here are the rules of the game. So in the same way that standard operating procedures help to improve the process yield and make sure that the raw material is of sufficiently consistent quality, then the same things apply here. So as we kind of document the process and let people know, if you can't tick these boxes, you're going to have trouble in the review process. And then we also do, we mentioned a while ago, some immediate revisions where Tyson or I or a department editor will see some problems with the paper that are going to take the attention of the review team, which means that we get less out of the review process. And that's a very labor-intensive process, and is going to make it likely that the paper is going to be rejected without as much constructive feedback as we'd like. So we'll send it back to the authors and say, fix that. And if you fix it, we'll send it out for review. Even if the paper gets rejected, it's not the same rejection. It's a rejection that is going to be more constructive.
Based on a deeper level of evaluation without the distraction that those initial glaring flaws would have caused.
Okay. Still regarding the global reach of the journal, do you break down the downloads per region or per country? Do you have any idea of how global Journal of Operations Management is?
Yeah, we've got pretty good information. And there's an article, a forum piece that a former EIC, co-EIC of the journal is finalizing that is looking at what has been happening in the journal and in the field. So Wiley and Elsevier both have been collecting a lot of data on this. Articles are coming.
But with the transition, we are shifting publishers here. So there probably will be a little bit of a disconnect in that, but we don't have those data at our fingertips at the moment. But it's fair to say that we get a large number of downloads from around the world in a very diversified sense. The readership is very international and diverse. That's a good thing.
Okay. So any open calls for special issues or future calls that you'd like to highlight?
Well, we've just about to, as in any day now, we're putting out a call for proposals for special issues. So the deadline currently is set for the end of June 2019 for potential guest editor teams to submit their proposals for new special issues. Meanwhile, we've got several special issues that are in progress, but none are currently still open for submissions. But in the pipeline, we have a special issue on the digitization of manufacturing that may be coming out later, maybe around the fall of this year. We've got a special issue on healthcare, effective care, lower cost, coming out later this year or early next. And then we've got a special issue on innovation and supply networks that should be coming out next year.
Okay. Do you have any initiative to publicize papers published in the journal to increase their impact or the reach outside the academic circles?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing is that we are working together with APEX or ASCM. They're interested in managerial versions of papers. We're also discovering that an increasing number of authors have communication departments at their university that are well connected in terms of the press. And so that, when the results are impactful, then often the press will be interested.
I think we always encourage authors to develop companion pieces in various outlets, whether those are the ones that academicians consider as top tier, like Sloan Management Review or Harvard Business Review or California Management Review or the new Management Business Research. These are all great potential targets for authors to have another outlet for more of an executive audience for their key findings. But there's all kinds of industry associations and magazines in various areas that provide more possibilities. And then, like Suzanne mentioned, sometimes particular authors or their universities will issue press releases that can be picked up by.
So the journal itself doesn't, I mean, you encourage, but you don't have a set.
We don't have a formal one yet. We've been in discussions about some of these, and we may be able to announce something at some point. But as of this point, we don't have a formal obligation to commit our papers to any particular sister publication or anything like that.
So there's one thing that I've had some experience with, and I've been, as an author, and I've been encouraging other authors to think about it. But it's, again, we've been weathering the transition between publishers and, just a few little things that have taken a tiny bit of time. But that doesn't mean that our to-do list is permanently on the back burner. So one of the things is, I'm very focused on development of decision tools which make what is nonlinear and counterintuitive more actionable by decision makers. Because most of our research is interesting because we're dealing with a nonlinear and or counterintuitive relationship, so that when people follow their quote-unquote common sense or their conventional wisdom, they're going to make a bad decision. And how do we, and so that our research having an impact means that people do things differently. Now, so one of the things that I've really focused on in my own research, which looks at making quantitative finance available to better value responsiveness in the supply chain, I've been focused on creating decision tools and making them available for free. So the U.S. Department of Commerce went live with one of the tools that my lab developed. It was also published, a description of it was published in JOM. And then a copy of the academic paper was made available on the U.S. Department of Commerce website with permission to distribute it freely for several years. And so industry associations would contact me to say, well, by the way, when we use your calculator, it looks like we actually could bring our manufacturing to this part of the world where we just thought it wasn't possible. You know, would you check our numbers? And I think this, for me, is the epitome of research. So anything that I can do that, and well, Tyson, you with the design structure matrix, you're doing the same thing. You're creating a tool people use, which let them get more out of their brain power. Mm-hmm. And so if we can do that and make it happen and encourage people to do that, then I think the journal will be better.
Right. So it's not impact and dissemination and relevance is not just magazine articles or SMR articles or something like that. In addition to JOM articles, it could be tools, things posted on websites, because the ultimate goal really is not these other outlets or articles, it is getting the research findings into practical use and relevance. So there are many potential ways to bridge those gaps. And, you know, I'm not sure if tweeting about your research result is the best way to do that, but it just reminds us that there are many channels these days, many ways that different audiences can pick up on the useful results. I also love to think about how the results of JOM papers are potentially showing up in MBA and executive education courses, and how the results disseminate to future leaders and managers that way. So there's all sorts of possibilities.
I see. But you don't gather any evidence on that.
Well, you know, we're looking at 34 papers, so that when we're looking at which papers are going to get the best paper award, then this is something that we take into consideration. And another thing is we've got this ambassador award that looks at papers that are cited outside of the field.
By non-OM journals. Yeah.
One thing that I think is worth mentioning is a lot of people just are not good writers. And if we are actually going to have impact beyond the research community, we need to write well, we need to write clearly, we need to have shorter papers. One thing which works is actually building decision tools into the paper. So rather than having exhaustive figures, instead people can go and play with their own values. I've done that in my own work, and it actually works quite well. So I would encourage people who are not naturally good writers to go find a good copy editor, and also take the paper and read it out loud to themselves so they can see exactly how hard it is to follow.
I found a very interesting tool on Microsoft Word that's read aloud. You can click on a button and it reads for you. So I found that, in fact, it helps you understand that you're not making any sense. Or it's interesting, isn't it? I read it, and then I have the computer reading it for me, and it changed the way I perceive my own paper.
Interesting.
So how do you compare the evolution of the research methods? You mentioned a lot about the emphasis on very good methods. How do you evaluate the evolution of the requirements for the research method?
So if you think about this, okay, so I'm married to a lawyer. And so that I think about, would this, you know, if this were argued in the court of law, you know, in front of a jury, would the results be convincing? You know, we really can't prove anything, but we can pose plausible arguments or less plausible arguments. That's why there are problems with things like endogeneity. It's like, well, that's one explanation, but there are many other explanations, and you haven't convinced me that yours is the correct one. So it really comes down to plausibility. You have observations. They can be cases. It can even be one quite dramatic observation all the way up to a large data set. And you're going to do things with it. And you're going to convince that the methods were well chosen, what we learned from the methods is plausible, and we're agnostic with respect to methods. And we are working on being able to handle a wide variety of methods. Also, you think about what's happening now with quote unquote big data. We have to do two things. The first thing that we have to do is, in a time where everybody's all excited about big data, we have to remember that much of the time big data means you've got a lot of data that doesn't answer the questions that need to be addressed. But then somebody has convinced you that if you just do enough to it, something interesting is going to come out. And we're like, no. We need to not be distracted by the fire hose of data that doesn't answer the questions that need to be addressed, and go back to the small data, which is we went and we collected, you know, a couple of weeks of data, or we got 24 data points, and it was enough to show that this is what seems to be going on, and it gets us started in the right direction. But then if there is going to be big data, which, you know, can be useful, although most of the time when we call it big data, we mean that we've already decided that it's not useful, but we'll leave that to the side. then we want to make sure that we are at the forefront of what is happening. Like, you know, for example, with machine learning, you end up with a model that is harder to interpret. You know, you've got less understanding of causality, but it's going to be better at predicting. So that, which is the better way to go? You've got trade-offs.
I would say a lot of the methodological rigor that is now associated with JOM is much greater than it was 10 to 20 years ago. That's a very clear change over that long time frame. Each of the previous groups of editors that have come in have tried to hold or increase the level of rigor in the journal. And I think this is going to be natural in the sense that, like we talked about earlier, we want to be relevant to other fields. We want to engage with our sister disciplines. And when we find that their top journals are publishing papers at a level of rigor that's different from ours, especially if ours are less rigorous, then if we want to be seen as true peers, if we want to be seen as strong, relevant, rigorous researchers, we need to be doing our research at the same level of rigor that our sister fields are. And so when we see a sister field that has methodology papers showing how survey results from single respondents, for example, can lead to drastic misperceptions and flawed conclusions about what's going on and why. And we look at our own publications that have used that construct, that design, and, you know, we can't really trust the results because now we can come up with more counterfactuals that the researchers did not dismiss, did not rule out. So now, if we want to continue to trust our own results and build on them in future research and have them appeal to these wider audiences of academicians and practitioners, we've got to make sure that our level of rigor in our methodologies is at least comparable, if not superior, to sister fields. This gives us the academic respect that we have and want to maintain, and it allows us to trust our own results and build on them. So these are the reasons for the methodological hurdles that seem to be getting higher in some cases to certain authors over time. But there are good explanations for them. There are good explanations available in papers, methodological papers published in the journal. And so, like, you know, some researchers have this idea that once I get my PhD, I know everything I'll ever need to know about research methods, and I'm only going to do the same type of research design for the rest of my life. Well, we all have more to learn. And sometimes being an editor is one of the best ways to see just how much more you have to learn or could learn about all these potential methods that are out there. So I would encourage authors to treat methods as an opportunity for lifelong learning and always be looking for ways to improve the methods you're using and get better at designing research a priori rather than post hoc attempts to rationalize what you did and why it still should be trusted. So that's a big improvement, I think.
So would you mind pointing to examples of papers? It doesn't need to be right now. You can send me later and I can publish it. But that would be interesting for listeners and for students to know, you know.
Of course, yeah, we have several methodology pieces that have come out just in the last year that will be very helpful.
Not only methodological pieces, say, for example, you just mentioned surveys. Mm-hmm. A good paper, not about the method, but about...
Using an appropriate design, for example.
That would be very helpful. I think that should mm-hmm. work.
One other thing, we can do that. One other thing I should probably mention is we seem to be getting more submissions with what are self-described as multi-method papers, because authors feel like, well, if I can't really do enough with one method, I better do a little bit with a lot of methods.
Yeah.
And sometimes that works, but reviewers are pretty critical when now we've, instead of one method to critique, we've got three or four methods to critique, and none of them are really that strong. And yes, papers have trade-offs, but trying to compensate for one weak method by adding three other weak methods isn't usually the right approach. So yes, triangulating, getting more points of view on what we're observing are all laudable, but for any of the methods in a multi-methods paper, they should still hold water. You can't say a poor survey design can be compensated for by, oh, we also did a case study. So.
Do you see any research topics that are trending, that you see that are rising in the horizon or surging in terms of submissions?
Well, there are ones that are surging and trending, and then there are ones that we really wish we would see surging and trending.
Okay.
So I see a lot of submissions around what has been called Industry 4.0, for example,
yeah,
which is a bit of an artificial construct, but we get the idea. Of course, it's the use and application of new technologies and production and supply networks. And we've always been and always will be interested in that topic. But papers that tend to try to motivate themselves through the use of any particular buzzword or hot trend or topic are usually, we view it with a little bit of skepticism and would prefer that they really ground themselves in the fundamentals, the foundations of operations management. Why do we need a new technology? What is it going to enable us to do? Better decisions, more efficiency, more effectiveness, more consistency. The fundamental metrics and KPIs of operations managers, as opposed to we should care about this because it's an exciting hot topic. So always make the connections to the fundamentals would be the advice there.
Okay. And what would you like to see more?
Well, we are actually thinking about moving toward a collection of articles on getting some hot topics back to basics, taking things back to things like factory physics. Because when you have a buzzword, this has happened very much with lean. You've had a period of 20 years where people have said, oh, good manufacturing is lean manufacturing. No, I'm sorry, that's wrong.
Or vice versa.
So that a process is going to have to balance its capacity utilization at the bottleneck, its inventory buildup, and its variability. Now, if we define a lean operation as one that is trying to have a high capacity utilization across all resources so that we don't have waste, and is avoiding inventory buildup, which, you know, leads to practices like Kanban, then what that means is that variability will need to be reduced across the board, which leads on the demand side to Heijunka, et cetera, on the process side to things like Andon or Kaizen. Now, you can see cases where this factory physics designed lean is going to work well, but there are also going to be other possibilities. Now, because we've just said, well, lean is good, and everybody understands, well, I'm sorry, the capacity buffer that lets me innovate is going to look to most decision makers a lot like waste. So you end up cutting off the innovation, saying, we're lean, and this should be good. Or
can't distinguish muscle from fat.
Yeah. And some fat is actually useful. That it takes fat to be able to sit back and think, which is how you come up with serious innovation. This is a discussion that has simply not taken place over the past 20 years. So we want to get that discussion going. In the same way, Six Sigma is one way of improving process consistency, but it leaves out a lot of basic stuff, and it leaves out the stuff that nobody wants to do because it requires discipline. So we want to go back to some of the things that preceded Six Sigma to get back to a richer, less reductionist way of thinking. But I could talk about that for 2 hours.
So those are some possibilities of things that we would like to see. I personally would like to see more papers that span the full spectrum of what I call the management of work. So most traditional operations management papers focus on the subset of that spectrum about repetitive work, where you're trying to do the same thing over and over and over. But the other end of that spectrum is the world of projects, where you're trying to do something new once. And some operations management journals, including JOM, publish explicitly papers on product development or project management. And we've recently opened this innovation and project management department to put greater emphasis and visibility on the fact that we do want to see papers about operations where you don't get to do it multiple times. You've got to get it right the first time. So how do you do that? How do you manage that type of operation? And then I would like to see a more holistic view of operations, even just within an enterprise. So a chief operating officer, what do they care about? And what is their job? It's not just production, or it shouldn't be. They should be interested in integrating the workflows across the entire enterprise. How is it that the understanding of markets and the development of new technologies integrates with the new product development process? How does that integrate with the production, the distribution processes, and the customer support processes? What are not just the feed forward relationships, but the feedback relationships among all of these different functions that are all doing work, all with this goal of adding value, but many of whom don't view that work as occurring in processes, don't view the integration of their work as the reason for a lot of the problems that are found in enterprises. I see huge potential in those directions to take a more holistic systems view of enterprises and how they integrate workflows across all their functions. And then, of course, we can carry that to the supply network levels as well, not just within organizations. So huge numbers of possibilities and research questions out there that I would love to see more submissions come in.
I have pretty much covered what I was expecting to listen. Would you have anything that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you that you'd like to talk about?
I think we've covered the most important things. And so we really appreciate your setting up this interview and for getting this the information about what the journals are doing out to people. That's the best way to help yes. authors understand the options that they have, understand what resources are available. It's also interesting for us to hear what other editors are doing.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. And I'll add that Suzanne and I are doing quite a bit, and the things are pretty dynamic from certain points of view. So we are always open to ideas and suggestions and possibilities.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us today and for sharing your insights with us. I really appreciate that.
No, thank you. Thanks for your interest.
Yes, thank you.
Listen to the Editors is an initiative of the Operations and Supply Chain Management Division of the Academy of Management. We post our interviews monthly in our division website. You can discuss any of the topics of this episode using our interactive tool, connect.aom.org. Using the discussion section of our site, you can also post suggestions for questions, journal editors you'd like to hear from, and requests for clarifications. You can also subscribe to our podcast in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or with the Podcast Addict app on Android. See you next month.